Well, so our next agenda item is an update on each stress test work party. And for that, we have the stress test party rapporteurs, Cheryl Landonor and Steve Del Bianco. So we have some late inclusions, or we could add late inclusions after July 15 to the stress test working party. And as I said, we have Steve and Cheryl for this. There are some 9 new stress tests, and we will be walked through these new stress tests by Cheryl and Steve. And for this, I would like to turn either to, I don't know if Steve or Cheryl would like to take the floor. Okay, so ladies first, as usual. Cheryl, could you please take the floor on this?
Thank you, Leon. Cheryl Langdonor for the record, and I hope you all enjoyed the free medical advice on the pharmacological aspects of drugs post-surgery that apparently the open mic took out to at least your Doe Connect room. But that's all right, a bit of experience and sharing, that works fine. Back to stress test working party. If we draw your attention to our update slide in front of you, as a result of activities in the public comment period and particular letters and memos associated with that same time period, we've added a couple of stress tests. We're going to have a look at and go into a slightly deeper dive on a couple of those in today's presentation, and once Steve's taken you through some of that material, we will have a little bit of extra interaction that we'd like to have a Q&A session, and we can certainly go into others of our stress tests, and indeed note that we haven't closed the books yet on these stress tests at all. So I think with that, let's just jump straight into it, Steve, and over to you.
Thank you, Cheryl. So all of you know that we had 26 stress tests in the original draft we published on the 3rd of May. And as Cheryl indicated, we've added 9. And those 9 came from a variety of places. So the slide you have in front of you in the Adobe Connect is a simple summary of what we've added. And I'll walk through that briefly without necessarily taking you into each and every page. I think that Grace and staff can put into the chat a hyperlink to the actual document that contains those stress tests, and all of the new ones that I'll be mentioning begin around page 25. And we'd be happy to take questions on specific text, but the co-chairs suggested we not walk you through all 9 new ones, but instead summarize what we've done and give you the opportunity to ask questions. So we took multiple sources. We took the CCWG discussions that were held in here since the publication, which was early May. We looked at public comments, and there were 11 public comments that specifically came in writing with regard to the stress tests. NTIA's letter, or Larry Strickling's blog, that was published before we all arrived in Buenos Aires, contained 4 stress tests they requested at NTIA. And then we had the ICANN board legal memo that came in on the 20th of June, which had 2 stress tests that were explicitly requested, and perhaps others that are implied. So the first thing we did was took a look at Chris Despain's stress tests. That got his attention, didn't it? You folks recall where Chris asked a really good question. He said, wait a minute. If an IRP decision can be enforced by a court, does that mean that a California court would interpret our mission and core values and our bylaws? And we quickly did some research to understand that that's not the way this IRP works. As Becky has indicated several times, if an IRP is a binding decision and the binding decision is reached and the board ignores the decision, then any court on the planet that recognizes international arbitration results could be turned to enforce the decision. And the enforcement of that decision only looks at whether the process was followed properly. It doesn't look at the merits of the underlying decision that the panel made, because that's the whole point of arbitration, was to use the panel. And I want to thank Chris for mentioning those 2 stress tests, and then when we came back to Chris with writing them up, concluding that it was not a significant risk, Chris was gracious enough to acknowledge, okay, I think we've got that covered, let's move on to some other issues. So that's in the document. There's probably not a need to go into too much detail on it. We also edited Stress Test 20 for a comment from the registry stakeholder group, who corrected us on the proper order of policy development before you can get to the point. And we added two new stress tests that were suggested by David Post and Danielle Kale. These were stress tests with respect to, well, it's a hot topic right now, whether in the new GTLD program, whether Specification 11 for registries, and the Registrar Accreditation Agreement 3.17, in other words, the obligation for a registrar to investigate and respond when given a report of abuse. And those abuses include things like malware, malicious code, trademark and copyright violations. So Danielle and David were very concerned that that would cause registrants to be terminated. And could they use the IRP as a way to challenge the interpretation of an RAA if it was in conflict with ICANN's new bylaws? Our conclusion was, well, yes, it would, in a binding decision. It could well unwind the enforcement decisions that ICANN would make. Now, this came up at the last Buenos Aires meeting because ICANN compliance hasn't yet determined what it intends to do when it enforces the obligation to investigate and respond. They're working on that, and presumably the public will have some input into that. And that decision on how to enforce it would be, a management decision, not a board decision. So when the management decides how to enforce that provision, I think that, too, would be subject to an IRP. Rosemary and Holly are nodding. Then let's move on to the middle one there. We added a stress test on rogue voting. Do you folks recall early in May, right after we published, there was this concern that by setting up, dare I say it, a UA or an avatar, we would create a situation where the person who is carrying the vote for a given AC or SO would not follow the instructions of the ACSO. Well, I know that in Buenos Aires we buried the UAs and rogue voting avatars, but the fact remains that if we have an empowered ACSO model, right, an AC or SO still has to have somebody who registers those five votes for the ALAC, say. That individual, it could be the chair of the ALAC, it's whoever the ALAC designates, but they have to sort of communicate that vote. It might be through an email, it could be through a raising of a hand or a vocal indication on a phone call, but they do need to communicate the vote faithfully to the AC or SO they're voting for. A scenario where if the voting was not faithful, well, then any officer or member of that underlying AC or SO, I used ALAC as the example, would quickly notify the community voting mechanism, hang on, we had a miscommunication. That gives you an opportunity to suspend that community powers vote. And by community power vote, of course, I'm talking about, say, a vote on whether to approve a bylaws change. So that vote would be suspended while ALAC works things out. I have no doubt that Alan and Cheryl would figure it out, deal with it. You might replace the person who was communicating the email. You might just clarify things.
What if we're the rogues?
Well, then we would count on the other ALAC members to hold you rogues to account, Al. There certainly could be counted on in the ALAC. I know that. So we think that answered well. And then NTIA, as I mentioned earlier on the 16th, I believe, of June, Larry Strickling sent, he put up a blog post, but inevitably, it's just like a memo or letter to all of us at CCWG. And he posited four new stress tests, which we've written up, and they're in the document on pages 30 through 33. I'll quickly summarize. The first was, hey, can we preserve the multi-stakeholder model if individual ACs and SOs opt out of having votes? I think you'll like the kind of the way the stress test team answered that. The first part of the answer was that, in keeping with a multi-equal stakeholder model, we invited all stakeholders to participate in the community powers of voting. And then we used an example like the SSAC and the RSSAC, who thus far indicated they probably won't take advantage of the voting mechanism. And we discussed the fact that that doesn't defeat the multi-stakeholder model because the SSAC and RSSAC are still going to give advice to the board and the community. They're still going to be just as active part of ICANN as ever they were. It's just that they felt they didn't want to vote on bylaws, changes in budgets, and strat plans. Instead, they want to give advice on the area of security, stability, and resiliency. And it may be that the rest of the ACs and SOs who do vote would turn to the SSAC and RSSAC for technical advice before casting a vote if it had a technical nature to it. We then went on to say that if, in fact, the GAC decided that it wasn't quite ready to enter a community voting mechanism. We went the next step. What if that happened and we were left with ALAC, ASO, GNSO, CCNSO? Would that be sufficiently representative of the global community? Well, a quick analysis says that when you get the CCNSO and the GNSO, you have the supporting organizations for the GTLDs and CCTLDs. And last I checked, those are the only two types of TLDs we have. The ASO picks up the numbers, and ALAC brings into place the end users and registrants in both those places. So it's still a rather multi-stakeholder, global representative body. Now, having said that, if we lose any of those key four, I think that's an opportunity to say maybe we need to reexamine whether we've really got a representative voting scheme. Okay? The next one was NTIA 2, which was the risk of internal capture. And you know this has come up many times. We had stress test number 12 and 13 back in May that partly addressed it. But here we explored it further. And this discussion occurred when Work Party 3 discussed the idea that structural reviews that are required in the bylaws, I think, can and should include whether there is a capture risk that's happening. We talked about the notion that members of a given group, let's say the GNSO where I live, if part of us in the GNSO felt we were being captured by contract parties, we would find a way to register that concern, although it would be unusual if you were captured. It would be unusual for you to get changes to your charter, changes to your operating procedures, if they had to be approved by people that had captured the voting. Capture can occur in other ways. It might be that a significant number of individuals from one particular point of view insert themselves into a working group or assert their voting power to elect their officers to a given constituency, stakeholder group, or AC or SO. So when that happens, we're going to need an ability for folks to sound the alarm. Presumably the ombudsman is another angle on that. But where do our community powers come in on this? They probably don't come in until, let's say, an AC or SO provides advice. An AC provides advice to the ICANN board, and the ICANN board acts on that advice. If members of that AC felt that it's advice that it actually was the result of a capture and it was tainted, it could challenge the board's decision to accept the advice through an IRP. The IRP looks to the bylaws, and the bylaws require a bottom-up multi-stakeholder process that potentially would be violated if the AC had tainted advice. So that's a little bit tortured, so we'll have to all have you all read pages 30 through 33 to see if we've covered it off. Very similar analysis for NTIA's third request, which was to examine how would we react if there were barriers to new entrants who came into the ICANN model and found themselves unable to penetrate the AC or SO that was most appropriate for them to be part of. So similar analysis where we do need to figure out whether the ombudsman is going to acquire any enforceable type powers as well. The fourth from the NTIA was, what are the unintended consequences of operationalizing a group that has thus far been advisory in nature? And NTIA said, for example, the GAC. The first thing we noted is that the GAC is quite operationalized today, that the GAC, through its advice, is able to affect significant aspects of ICANN's operations. One need only look at the operation of the new GTLD program to understand that. With respect to safeguards and advice on strings, the GAC has been very active in that regard. So I would ask NTIA what specifically they meant to be operationalized that we aren't in today. But nonetheless, we went in on that particular analysis to show that operationalizing, in many respects, is simply recognizing that governments, along with every other stakeholder, is entitled to express, as a global stakeholder, as a multi-equal stakeholder, express their views. And that's why there was an invitation to all ACs and SOs to exercise voting powers in the community powers. If for whatever reason they don't, then that's a choice that they made and not a choice where they were disenfranchised. Okay, then we added two questions from the board legal memo that came over on the 20th of June. We added two that were regarding stress tests specifically, and they had to do with what unintended consequences would arise from empowering entities who are not required to act in the best interest of ICANN as a whole, and have stress tests been conducted for each of these consequences. And then what are the risks associated with empowering members to bring lawsuits against ICANN? The stress test team has parked those two items because we will address them after the CCWG has adopted a new reference model for the enforceability part of our community powers, because that enforceability part will or will not bring with it this risk of individual lawsuits under statutory powers granted in California. They may or may not be there. They might only be constrained to a single member, a community as a single member, in which case we had slides earlier from the lawyers explaining why that is a mitigated risk. So we'll have to pick up that later. And then the last item on here was brought to us by Malcolm Huddy, who's done a superb job mapping out a flow chart. I think we'll talk about that tomorrow when we review the IRP. But Malcolm asks, so many of the stress tests, in fact, most of them, rely upon the crown jewels of the new and improved IRP with its binding nature in order to be able to hold the corporation to the bylaws. And what Malcolm asked us to assess is there's two critical assumptions there. You have to assume that when an IRP is properly filed that the board must agree to be bound by the decision. If there's discretion on the part of the board about whether to be bound, what good is the binding? And the second is the enforceability of a binding decision that's returned from an IRP panel. And I think that one was easy to answer, and Holly's agreeing. We think we have that covered in any court that recognizes international arbitration results. So we'll save that for tomorrow, and Becky and everyone else can cover that during the IRP session, okay? All right, finally, I'm going to turn it over to Cheryl to talk about where we're going in the future realm, and then we can take questions.
Well, actually, Steve, I think seeing as we have both a question in the chat pertinent to NTIA 4, we should probably deal with that now, and Chris has his hand up. So let's deal with the NTIA 4 question from Kavus in the chat, where he says he does not understand the objectives of NTIA question number 4. And then to you, Chris.
Kavus, would you like us to just respond to that? Or do you want to speak to that question?
I want to speak, if you allow me.
Go ahead.
Yes. Thanks. Two questions. First, I don't understand the objectives of the question 4 of NTIA. I was typing something in the chat, but I shortened it and said that does it mean that if GAC opts to remain advisor in advisory capacity, it will be excluded for exercising any of those six powers, totally.
Maybe.
Remains advisory, but does not have any right to exercise any powers if the bylaw changes, if the fundamental and so on, so forth, except the removal of the board member because GAC does not designate any board member. This is question one. And the question two, I don't understand the question of the ICANN, that ICANN must agree to the binding. What does it mean that? Thank you.
Thank you, Kavus. The must agree to binding is with respect to the IRP, not the other community voting powers. So why don't we cover that tomorrow, and I believe that the IRP session tomorrow will be able to drill into that. Let me turn to your first question, and you ask, what was the objective of asking about NTIA number 4? In truth, you probably have to ask Larry Strickling or the representatives of NTIA who are in the back of the room, but let me take a guess to it. They asked, without stating an objective, they simply said, what are the unintended consequences? Are there any unintended consequences of operationalizing a group like the GAC, who has formerly just been advisory and now will be voting in a community power in addition to being advisory? So it wasn't an either or. So I think it's a fair question, and it gets to the notion that will that change the nature of that body, that AC like the GAC? Will it change the nature of how you conduct your business? Will it in other ways change the way ICANN operates? So if you check page 33 of the document, you'll see the way we wrote that up is that we believe there are several ways in which the GAC's particular impact on operations is being changed, modified in certain ways as part of the proposal. Stress test 18 is among them, and that the IRP challenges are another one. And that those, in a sense, balance the new voting power that the GAC has been invited to exercise. But it's a fair question for NTIA to say, what are the unintended consequences, both for that AC itself, the GAC, and the unintended consequences for the ICANN as a whole? And we believe that this stress test probably answers positively.
Chris?
Thanks, Cheryl. Oh, crumbs. Thank you, Cheryl. Steve, I actually always wanted to talk about the fourth NTIA question, but in a slightly different way, and I apologize if I misheard you. Steve, I may have misheard you, but I just wanted to check. My concern is a slightly different concern than what I think is intended by question four. My concern is where we create a model, or we end up with a model where one of our groups, and in this particular case the focus is on the GAC, is actually unable to belong to that model. What I think I heard you say is that that's their problem. If they can't, they have a choice, they can belong or they can't. I agree if they have a choice. There are some areas where I think actually they simply cannot belong. Mm.
Because of this legal personhood?
Yeah, exactly. The concept of governments actually, they will have their own different rules, and I'm not trying to speak for individual governments, but I do know that there are major issues. So all I want to do is just to flag the point that I don't think we can simply say it's available to you. If you choose to use it, that's up to you. I think there are some circumstances where it actually is impossible for them to use it, and there are some circumstances where it would be impossible for members of them to use it. And in that case, that applies to the CCTLD world, where, for example, there would be some CCTLDs that are government-owned that would be constrained in a similar way to the way that their colleagues would be constrained. I just not making it the point for any other reason than just to be clear. Thank you.
Chris, if I might respond, I'm not a lawyer, an engineer, so I tend to look at this a little bit differently. The five community powers, the ability to vote on a bylaws change, the ability to vote on a budget veto, they have nothing whatsoever to do with the enforceability model. The bylaws themselves, which created the ACs and SOs, would be modified to allow those ACs and SOs to vote with that weighted voting on a decision. And none of that requires personhood of any kind. And so the decision to participate in a power was what the NTIA 4 was asking about. It wasn't asking about the down-the-road enforceability. It simply said if the GAC decided to help contribute to the voting, they'd be 5 of the 25 votes if you knock off the 4 for the RSAC and SAC. And the casting of a vote, it doesn't require any modification to any of the ACs and SOs. And it doesn't require that they be a person. So I don't know why we conflate those two. This personhood thing only has to do with the down-the-road enforceability. And please, lawyers, kick in if I've got that wrong.
Can I just respond briefly? Because I may have been misunderstood. I'm not actually disagreeing with what you said. What I was trying to do is to spin off the NTIA question four and make a slightly different point. But I would say, again, and this is something that we need to check, I would say again that there are very nuanced challenges for governments in voting. Governments have rules about empowering other governments to vote on their behalf. They have rules about representation on bodies that vote. For example, we've talked in the past about the GAC actually having a board member rather than a liaison. That's incredibly challenging for them. Getting them to put representatives onto various committees becomes incredibly challenging. I'm simply flagging this as I don't want our model to be made in a way that by dint of its existence excludes the GAC from being able to participate. Thanks.
We were having a little confab down here, and it seems to me and Steve, without having consulted the rest of the stress test working party, that by breaking NTIA 4 up to 4A and 4B, we can in fact test exactly that proposition. It's written down in red on Steve's paper, therefore it shall be so.
Once we have the model anyway,
it just says it at the end.
And Chris, it's the opposite of NTIA 4.
Yeah.
It's not the unintended consequences of participating.
Right.
It's whether there are structural impediments to being able to participate at all.
Incorrect.
Do I have that right?
Correct, which is why I started by saying it's starting to be thinking about it a different way.
Instead of NTIA 4B, it'll Chris Despain number 3.
No.
I prefer anonymity if you don't.
We'll manage that later. Okay. Have we got any other questions?
All right, please look at the document, and we're here all week. We can take questions. Thank you.
Just before we wrap up, however, I do want to make it very, very clear that the work of the Stress Test Working Party is a dynamic and ongoing one. The outcomes of the deliberations of this cross-community working group on what model it may end up with as its preferred reference model is absolutely pivotal to how we then run a number of these stress tests. So this is not work which will be completed with the publishing of the second public comment document. This is work that will need to respond and react, for example, to what happens as a result of our second public comment run through. And to that end, I would like to suggest to any of you who are currently deeply engaged in your time and energy into one of the other work parties that our doors remain open. Our weekly meetings are occasionally cancelled, but not that often cancelled, and that you are more than welcome, in particular when we move into this next phase once reference models are established and we have some tighter framework for running the existing stress tests we had. I also want to make sure that you're all aware of the fact that the books are not closed on these stress tests as yet. We, as you saw, literally are contemplating adding one at the table right here as a result of Chris's intervention. So if you, as a cross-community working group member or participant, feel that there is something we need to stress test, there is no reason why we cannot consider it. But I would also like to make sure that when your workload changes a little, that you feel more than welcomed to join us in the ongoing work of the stress testing that is necessary. And with that...
We have two people in the queue.
Okay, I'm going to go to Seth first, and followed by Kavit. Seth, and that's the remote.
Okay, just tell me if this is not coming through.
Loud and clear, Seth.
I'm getting an
echo, but I'll just talk over it.
Okay, I'm looking at the... I mostly analyzed your five stress test categories, and you basically boiled down to only stress test 2 and 5 are relevant to the IANA transition. And those are in areas that are actually functional aspects of... of what ICANN and IANA do in the case of Category 2. And in the case of Test Category 5, which appeared to be mostly about external stakeholders, it's really interpreting it in terms of loss of explicit provisions, like the AOC might be terminated, or if you delegate IANA to a third party, you might be under another national law, or if you drop your presence in a nation, the people in that country would not be would not have legal recourse. Redress according to the instruments at play. Now, all of these are functional aspects of explicit provisions, okay, and all the rest you say are not relevant to the INA. Now, what I want to ask has to do with, is relevant to the document on CCWG that jurisdiction, which a corollary question is, when are we going to discuss that in the agenda? And but my point, my question is, shouldn't you be looking at the effects on fundamental rights? Because I can look at the litigation in existing law, stress test 3 and 4, and new law, national injunction against redelegation could be about a fundamental rights issue. And a court order against delegation might be about a fundamental rights issue. And so people in the U.S. or if you look at the stress test number 18, which you've already mentioned, the GAC might switch to a majority vote principle, and then ICANN would necessarily have to, I forget the terminology, negotiate a reasonable outcome or acceptable outcome with them. But under what I guess is interpreted as a lower standard, just a majority as opposed to consensus. Well, that's a very weird one, because the truth of the matter is, if the GAC did that today, if the GAC got a bunch of governments, majority of them voted on some rule and leaned on ICANN to implement it, copyright is a perfect example. It impinges on fundamental rights, right? And it, you know, if they, that represents a transition from removing the NTIA. If that happened today, a U.S. citizen would sue the NTIA for allowing some a corporate entity to have that happen to the U.S. So the recourse that U.S. citizens have against fundamental rights claims against their own government because it happened to be presently involved goes away in many cases when you take them out, when suddenly the legal arena is international law, where if the best standard of review you're going to get for an international human right is a balancing standard because governments write both the human rights treaty and any other treaty. Okay, so my question is, if we have a discussion of CCWG jurisdiction in light of that, because I don't think that that conclusion about the scope of CCWG is correct. I think that you have to assume there's a change in jurisdiction. It isn't that CCWG doesn't change jurisdiction. They have to address that. That's part of the problem in the transition to the international arena, the loss of fundamental rights, and that should be part of your stress test. So if our discussion leans that way, would you re-go back at these stress tests and address that question? I'm sorry it took a long time. I think it was a very important point that needs to be raised.
Dave?
Yeah, Seth, two fundamental misunderstandings on your behalf, and it might be that we have to catch you up on what the stress tests are all about in ways that were not obvious the way we wrote them up, and I'm sorry for that. The first is, you asked about which ones affect the proposals of CWG stewardship of numbers and protocols. On page 3 of the stress test document, we list that there are a dozen of the stress tests that do affect the operations of the IANA functions. And I think what you were focusing on is at the bottom of each and every stress test table in the left-hand corner is a statement of whether it is or is not directly related to the fact of the transition. So that's a cause and effect indicator. The co-chairs asked us to put it in there, and we did. The stress test team put it in there. And it's of no consequence whatsoever since the work of the CCWG is about the overall accountability of ICANN due to the lack of future leverage once the IANA contract is gone. So the words directly related is simply a cause and effect statement, and it has no relevance. But if you want to know which of the stress tests address the functioning of IANA functions, you would go to page 3 of our document. The second point you brought up about suing NTIA, I have no idea if and whether that could even happen today. But, of course, it wouldn't matter at all once NTIA lets go of the contract, and that's the world we're trying to design around. So if you want to put that toothpaste back in the tube,
exactly
good luck to
point.
You. But let me, not, but hang
exactly
on, hang on.
Point.
So Seth, it's our turn. It's our turn, Seth, and we're not hearing you in any event. But, Seth, you mentioned Stress Test 18, and in fact, if the GAC decided today that it wanted to change its operating procedures, it could do so. A majority of the GAC could vote at two subsequent meetings, and they could change their decision-making processes from the absence of objection to simple majority or whatever the GAC wants. That's their business. And if they did so, they don't even have to get the approval of ICANN. That's something that's in the operating procedures of the GAC. And it's because of that that Stress Test 18 inserted one new line into the bylaws, or proposes to insert one new line. It says that we like the way that it works today and has since the beginning, which is that when the GAC works on the basis of consensus, then those decisions carry with it an obligation for the board to try and find a mutually acceptable solution in cases where it's unwilling to accept the GAC advice. And that's a unique power that only the GAC has. No other AC carries the obligation of trying to find a mutually acceptable solution. So Stress Test 18 simply says that only where it's consensus, and that's exactly the way the GAC works today.
I completely understand.
Right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Excuse me.
Sorry, Seth. What I'm going to suggest is, because your audio is not particularly coming through at the moment, and it really isn't coming through at the moment, our next meeting for the Stress Test Working Party would be one of the ideal opportunities for any possible new stress test to be discussed, and I look forward to your contributions on this matter and other matters when you join us. I saw Kavous's hand come up and go down, so I think the next order is actually Izumi, and then we'll go to you, Kavous. So, Izumi, and then we have closed after.
Thanks. So I'm trying to think of how the stress test can help in as a reference for us to decide on which model would be desirable for us. I think I understand the status that we haven't really go into the analysis of a particular model until we decide it. But can we do it the other way around? So, for example, compare different models and then do the stress test, including how this particular model could affect in destabilizing ICANN, for example, because I think this is another thing that it's important for us to ensure. So whether a particular model will not be susceptible for capture by a particular group, or it doesn't increase the possibility to be sued. I mean, I'm just listing them as examples. And then if we can compare them, it could be a useful reference for us in thinking about which particular model might be helpful.
Thanks, Izumi. Please sit.
Izumi, the vast majority of the stress test analysis, which have been coming out by positive, saying that the proposed solutions enhance and are adequate to hold the corporation accountable to the community. Those conclusions rely upon the enforceability of a community power to block a budget, save a bylaw, enforce a decision. So that enforceability is an inherent assumption. The degree of enforceability and how it's done is not there. It's just that the assumption is that these powers have teeth and they're not merely advisory. So that's done without knowing or caring whether the enforcement happens through a member or a designator. None of that matters to the way the stress tests have been analyzed so far. The second part of what you said is that once we come up with our reference model, perhaps there's a new stress test about would ICANN find itself in court more frequently as a result of the new reference model. It's somewhat covered by what we added for the Chris de Spain, the two we added in May, the California courts, with respect to the IRP. But if there are other statutory powers that members would acquire, and we pick a member model, please work with Cheryl and I and the work party. We'll design a few stress tests for that.
Kavous, you have the shortest amount of time humanly possible for your intervention.
Short, yes. It will be always a great pleasure to talk physically with Steve Del Bianco. He's very, very pleasant with his smile and his estival suit and so on and so forth. I'm not in favor of stress test 18. I was against from the very beginning. He was not happy, but it's more easy to talk to him physically than electronically. Thank you.
Thank you, and luckily stress test 18 can be dealt with a little later in Workstream 2. Thank you, one and all. We hope we've helped you understand what our working party's been doing.
Thank you very much, Cheryl. Thank you very much, Steve. And we are now open for lunch. And, the important thing about the stress test is to remember that whatever new stress test the stress working party has come up to doesn't modify our proposal so far. And also, what's most important is that we need to come to choosing a model, because otherwise the stress test working party will be continuing to... I see Thomas Schneider hand is up. Thomas, could you please?
Yes, thank you, and good late morning, everybody. I don't want to be long. I just want to share with you a personal impression. This morning has been very exciting. A lot of new ideas have come in, and to some extent it feels like we're in the beginning of a process where we'll have 2.5 years' time to sort everything out. Which may not be the case, at least not if you look at Workstream 1 where it says... enhance accountability within the time frame for the transition. And from what I understand, the time frame to agree on things to be implemented by June next year is until Dublin. So I think maybe we should all spend some time during lunch brainstorming on how we, I miss the best words in English, on how we slim down Workstream 1
and the way we deal with it before tomorrow evening, in the sense that, and I would propose to really have a look again at the CWG proposal with the focus of what exactly, in what context, in what substance is required from the CCWG to make the CWG-ICG proposal work. So look at the changements that leaving the NTIA from the contract, getting a contract between ICANN and the PTI, what are the concrete elements that they need for the transition to happen, and to try and focus on this, and then take the big bulk of the global holistic enhancement of ICANN's accountability mechanisms, maybe for once we've dealt with the concrete questions that the CWG is asking us. That's just a little bit of food for thought for lunch. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Thomas. We welcome your comment, of course, and this is food for thought, and we can go through this over lunch. So last, I have a poll before we go to lunch. So
sure.
You're standing between lunch.
Paul Rosenzweig, I won't stand long between lunch except to register my very strong disagreement with the statement just made. We have, for the last 8 months, pegged accountability not exclusively to the IANA transition and the CWG's work, but rather to a broader enhancement of accountability for ICANN, and I believe that it would be a grave error to see the imminent deadline as something that forces us to essentially get rid of the superstructure of accountability we've been working on, and I would urge those who are members to reject that.
Thank you very much, Paul. And with that, we will now go to lunch. So do you have any announcements, Grace, as with regards to we'll be able to leave our things here or not?
Yes, so you'll be able to leave things in the room. There'll be someone in the room at all times, and we'll be reconvening in 1 hour, max.
And ladies and gentlemen, lunch is upstairs in the gallery, so you can follow the signs that they have nicely placed. It's to the left of the jazz club.
Thank you very much. Okay. Let's break and reconvene in 1 hour. Thank you.
You can leave all of your computers here. As Grace said, there will always be somebody in the room.